Allen to report to Moscow immediately. What's the problem? The problem is we have another leak. Lee Allen is a very effective officer. I know the material he's sending back. So do the Americans. Get that message off at once. Then I want everything we have from Thistle on my desk. Golovko hung up and looked at the major standing in front of his desk. That mathematician who figured this all out. Good God, I wish we'd had him 5 years ago. He spent 10 years devising this theory on order and chaos. If it's ever made public, he'll win the Planck Medal. He took the work of Mandelbrot at Harvard University in America, and Mackenzie at Cambridge, and... I will take your word for it, Major. The last time you tried to explain this witchcraft to me, I merely got a headache. How is the work going? We grow stronger every day. The only thing we cannot break is the new CIA system that's starting to come online. It seems to use a new principle. We're working on it. President Fowler boarded the Marine VH-3 helicopter before the snow got too bad, painted a shiny olive drab on the bottom, with white on top and little else in the way of markings. It was his personal bird, with the call sign Marine 1. Elizabeth Elliot boarded just behind him, the press corps noted. Pretty soon they'd have to break the story on the two, some thought. Or maybe the president would do the job for them by marrying the bitch. The pilot, a Marine Lieutenant Colonel, brought the twin turbine engines to full power, then eased up on the collective, rising slowly and turning northwest. He was almost instantly on instruments which he didn't like. Flying blind and on instruments didn't trouble him. Flying blind and on instruments with the president aboard did. Flying in snow was about the worst thing there was. All external visual references were gone. Staring out the windshield could turn the most seasoned airman into a disoriented and air-sick feather merchant in a matter of seconds. As a result, he spent far more time scanning his instruments. The chopper had all manner of safety features, including collision avoidance radar, plus having the undivided attention of two senior air traffic controllers. In some perverse ways, this was a safe way to fly. In clear air, some lunatic with a Cessna might just try to perform a mid-air with Marine 1, and maneuvering to avoid such things was a regular drill for the colonel, both in the air and in the aircraft simulator at Anacostia Naval Air Station. "Wind's picking up faster than I expected," the co-pilot, a major, observed. "May get a little bumpy when we hit the mountains. Should have left a little sooner." The pilot switched settings on his intercom box, linking him with the two Secret Service agents in back. "May want to make sure everybody's strapped in tight. Picking up a little chop." "Okay, thanks," Pete Connor replied. He looked to see that everyone's seatbelt was securely fastened. Everyone aboard was too seasoned a flyer to be the least bit concerned, but he preferred a smooth ride as much as the next person. The president, he saw, was fully relaxed, reading over a folder that had just arrived a few minutes before they'd left. Connor settled back also. Connor and D'Agostino loved Camp David. A company of hand-picked Marine riflemen provided perimeter security. They were backed up and augmented by the best electronic surveillance systems America had ever built. Backing everyone up were the usual Secret Service agents. Nobody was scheduled to come in or out of the place this weekend, except possibly one CIA messenger who would drive. Everyone could relax, including the president and his lady friend, Connor thought. This is getting bad. Better tell the weather pukes to stick their head out the window. They said 8 inches. I got a buck says more than a foot. I never bet against you on weather, the co-pilot reminded the colonel. Smart man, Scotty. Supposed to clear tomorrow night. I'll believe that when I see it, too. Temp's supposed to drop to 0 too, maybe a touch under. That I believe, the colonel said, checking his altitude, compass, and artificial horizon. His eyes went outboard again, seeing only snowflakes being churned by the downwash of the rotor tips. What do you call visibility? Oh, in a clear spot, maybe 100 feet, maybe 150? The major turned to grin at the colonel. The grin stopped when he started thinking about the ice that might build up on the airframe. "What's the outside temp?" he murmured to himself. -12°C, the colonel said before he could look at the thermometer. "Coming up?" "Yeah. Let's take her down a little. Ought to be colder." Goddamn D.C. weather. 30 minutes later, they circled over Camp David. Strobe lights told them where the landing pad was. You could see down better than in any other direction. The co-pilot looked aft to check the fairing over the landing gear. "We got a little ice now, Colonel. Let's get this beast down before something scary happens. Wind is 30 knots at 300. Starting to feel a touch heavy. The VH-3 could pick up as much as 400 pounds of ice per minute under the wrong weather conditions. Fucking weather weenies. Okay, I got the LZ Insight. 200 feet, airspeed 30, the major read off the instruments. 150 at 25. 100 at under 20. Looking good. 50 feet and 0 ground speed. The pilot eased down on the collective. The snow on the ground started blowing up from the rotor wash. It created a vile condition called a whiteout. The visual references, which had just reappeared, vanished instantly. The flight crew felt themselves to be inside a ping-pong ball. Then a gust of wind swung the helicopter around to the left, tilting it also. The pilot's eyes immediately flicked down to the artificial horizon. He saw it tilt, knowing that the danger that had appeared was as severe as it was unexpected. He moved the cyclic to level the aircraft and dropped the collective to the floor. Better a hard landing than catching a rotor in the trees he couldn't see. The helicopter dropped like a stone, exactly 3 feet. Before people aboard realized that something was wrong, the helicopter was down and safe. "And that's why they let you fly the boss," the major said over the intercom. "Nice one, Colonel." "I think I broke something." "I think you're right." The pilot keyed the intercom. "Sorry about that. We caught a gust over the pad. Everybody okay back there?" The president was already up, leaning into the cockpit. "You were right, Colonel. We should have left sooner." "My mistake," Fowler said graciously. What the hell, he thought, he wanted this weekend. The Camp David detachment opened the chopper's door. An enclosed Humvee pulled up to it so that the president and his party didn't have to get too cold. The flight crew watched them pull away, then checked for damage. "Thought so." "Metering pin?" The major bent down to look. Sure enough. The landing had just been hard enough to snap the pin that controlled the hydraulic shock absorber on the right side landing gear. It would have to be fixed. "I'll go check to see if we have a spare," the crew chief said. 10 minutes later, he was surprised to learn that they didn't. That was annoying. He placed a phone call to the helicopter base at the old Anacostia Naval Air Station to have a few driven up. Until it arrived, there was nothing that could be done. The aircraft could still be flown in an emergency, of course. A fire team of Marine riflemen stood close guard on the helicopter, as always, while another squad walked perimeter guard in the woods around the landing pad area. "What is it, Ben?" "Does this place have a dorm?" Goodley asked. Jack shook his head. "You can use the couch in Nancy's office if you want. How's your paper coming?" "I'm going to be up all night anyway. I just thought of something."
"What's that?"
"Going to sound a little crazy. Nobody ever checked to make sure that our friend Kadyshev actually met with Narmanov."
"What do you mean?"
"Narmanov was out of town most of last week. If there was no meet, then the guy was lying to us, wasn't he?" Jack closed his eyes and cocked his head to one side.
"Not bad, Dr. Goodley. Not bad. We have Narmanov's itinerary. I have people checking on Kadyshev's now. I'm going all the way back to last August. If we're going to do a check, it might as well be a comprehensive one. My position piece might be a little late, but this hit me this morning, actually. I've been chasing it down most of the day. It's harder than I thought."
Jack motioned to the storm outside. "Looks like I'm going to be stuck here a while.
Want some help? Sounds good to me. Let's get some dinner first. Oleg Yuryevich Lyalin boarded his flight to Moscow with mixed feelings. The summons was not all that irregular. It was troublesome that it had come so soon after his meeting with the CIA director, but that was probably happenstance. More likely it had to do with the information he'd been delivering to Moscow about the Japanese Prime Minister's trip to America. One surprise he had not told CIA concerned Japanese overtures to the Soviet Union to trade high technology for oil and lumber. That deal would have upset the Americans greatly only a few years earlier, and marked the culmination of a 5-year project that Lyalin had worked on. He settled into his airline seat and allowed himself to relax. He had never betrayed his country, after all, had he? The satellite uplink trucks were in 2 batches. There were 11 network vehicles, all parked just at the stadium wall. 200 meters away were 31 more, smaller KU-band uplinks for what looked like regional TV stations, as opposed to the bigger network's fans. The first storm had passed, and what looked like a tank division's worth of heavy equipment was sweeping up the snow from the stadium's enormous parking lot. There was the spot, Gohn thought, right next to the ABC-A unit. There was a good 20 meters of open space. The absence of security astonished him. He counted only 3 police cars, just enough to keep drunks away from men trying to get their work done. So secure, the Americans felt. They'd tamed the Russians, crushed Iraq, intimidated Iran, pacified his own people, and now they were as totally relaxed as a people could be. They must love their comforts, Ibrahim told himself. Even their stadia had roofs and heat to keep the elements out. Gonna knock those things over like dominoes, Marvin observed from the driver's seat. Indeed we will, Gohn agreed. See what I told you about security? I was wrong to doubt you, my friend. Never hurts to be careful. Russell started another drive around the perimeter. We'll come in this gate right here and just drive right up. The headlights of the van illuminated the few flakes of this second storm. It was too cold to snow a lot, Russell had explained. This Canadian air mass was heading south. It would warm up as it hit Texas, dropping its moisture there instead of on Denver, which had 0.5 meters, Gohn estimated. The men who cleared the roads were quite efficient. As with everything else, the Americans liked their conveniences. Cold weather. Build a stadium with a roof. Snow on the highways, get rid of it. Palestinians, buy them off. Though his face didn't show it, he had never hated America more than at this moment. Their power and their arrogance showed in everything they did. They protected themselves against everything, no matter how big or small, knew that they did, and proclaimed it to themselves and the whole world. Oh, God, to bring them down. The fire was agreeably warm. The president's cabin at Camp David was in the classic American pattern, heavy logs laid one atop the other, though on the inside they were reinforced with Kevlar fiber, and the windows were made of rugged polycarbonate to stop a bullet. The furniture was an even more curious mix of ultra-modern and old comfortable. Before the couch he sat on were 3 printers for the major news services, because his predecessors liked to see the wire copy, and there were 3 full-size televisions, one of which was usually tuned to CNN. But not tonight. Tonight, it was on Cinemax. 0.5 miles away was a discreetly sited antenna farm that tracked all of the commercial satellites, along with most of the military ones, a benefit of which was access to every commercial satellite channel, even the X-rated ones, which Fowler didn't bother with, creating the world's most expensive and exclusive cable system. Fowler poured himself a beer. It was a bottle of Dortmunder Union, a popular German brew that the Air Force flew over. Being president did carry some useful and unofficial perks. Liz Elliott drank a French white while the president's left hand toyed with her hair. The movie was a sappy comedic romance that appealed to Bob Fowler. The female lead, in fact, reminded him of Liz in looks and mannerisms. A little too snappy, a little too domineering, but not without redeeming social value. Now that Ryan was gone, well, on the way to be gone, maybe things would settle down. "We've certainly done well, haven't we?"
"Yes, we have, Bob."
She paused for a sip of wine. "You were right about Ryan. Better to let him go honorably. So long as he's gone, along with that little shrew he married."
"I'm glad to hear you say that. He's not a bad guy. Just old-fashioned. Out of date."
"Obsolete," Liz added.
"Yeah," the president agreed.
"Why are we talking about him?"
"I can think of better things."
She turned her face into his hand and kissed it.
"So can I," the president murmured as he set his glass down.
"The roads are covered," Kathy reported. "I think you made the right decision."
"Yeah, there was just a bad one on the parkway just outside the gate. I'll be home tomorrow night. I can always steal one of the 4x4s they have downstairs."
"Where's John?"
"He's not here right now."
"Oh,"
Kathy observed. "And what might he be up to?"
"While I'm here, I might as well get some work done. Call you in the morning."
"Okay, bye." "That's one aspect of this place that I won't miss," Jack told Goodley.
"Okay, what have you developed?"
"We've been able to verify all the meetings through September."
"You look like you're ready to drop. How long have you been up?"
"Since yesterday, I guess."
"Must be nice to be still in your 20s. Grab a piece of the couch outside," Ryan ordered.
"What about you?"
"I want to read over this stuff again." Jack tapped the file on his desk.
"You're not into this one yet. Go get some Z's."
"See you in the morning."
The door closed behind Goodley. Jack started to read through the Nitaka documents, but soon lost concentration. He locked the file in his desk and found a piece of his own couch, but sleep wouldn't come. After a few minutes of staring at the ceiling, Ryan decided that he might as well stare at something less boring. He switched on the TV. Jack worked the controller to catch a news broadcast, but he hit the wrong button and found himself staring at the tail end of a commercial on Channel 20, an independent Washington station. He almost corrected the mistake when the movie came back. It took a moment. Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner. Black and white. Australia.
"Oh, yeah," Ryan said to himself. It was on the beach. He hadn't seen that in years. A Cold War classic from Neville Shute, wasn't it?
A Gregory Peck movie was always worth the trouble. Fred Astaire, too. The aftermath of a nuclear war. Jack was surprised at how tired he was. He'd been getting his rest lately, and he went to sleep, but not all the way. As sometimes happened to him, the movie entered his mind, though the dream was in color, and that was better than the black and white print on the TV, his mind decided, then decided further to watch the movie in its entirety. From the inside, Jack Ryan began to take over various roles. He drove Fred Astaire's Ferrari in the bloody and last Australian Grand Prix. He sailed to San Francisco in the USS Sawfish, SSN 623. Except, part of his mind objected, that 623 was the number of a different submarine. USS Nathan Hale, wasn't it? And the Morse signal, the Coke bottle on the window shade, that wasn't very funny at all, because it meant that he and his wife would have to have that cup of tea, and he really didn't want to do that because it meant he had to put the pill in the baby's formula so that he could be sure that the baby would die, and his wife wasn't up to it. Understandable, his doctor was a wife, and he had to take the responsibility because he was the one who always did, and wasn't it a shame that he had to leave Ava Gardner on the beach, watching him sail so that he and his men could die at home, if they made it, which they probably wouldn't, and the streets were so empty now. Kathy and Sally and little Jack were all dead,
and it was all his fault because he made them take their pills so that they wouldn't die of something else that was even worse. But that was still dumb and wrong, even though there wasn't much of a choice, was there? So instead, why not use a gun to do it and... What the fuck? Jack snapped upright as though driven by a steel spring. He looked at his hands, which were shaking rather badly, until they realized that his mind was under conscious control now. You just had a nightmare, boy. And this one wasn't the helicopter with Buck and John. It was worse. Ryan reached for his cigarettes and lit one, standing up after he did so. The snow was still coming down. The scrapers weren't keeping pace with it down on the parking lot. It took time to shake one of these off, watching his family die like that. So many of the goddamn things. I've got to get away from this place. There were just too many memories, and not all of them were good. The wrong call he'd made before the attack on his family. The time in the submarine. Being left on the runway at Sheremetyevo Airport and looking at good old Sergei Nikolaevich from the wrong side of a pistol. And worst of all, that helicopter ride out of Colombia. It was just too much. It was time to leave. Fowler, and even Liz Elliott, were doing him a favor, weren't they? Whether they knew it or not. Such a nice world lay out there. He'd done his part. He'd made parts of it a little better, and it helped others to do more. The movie he'd just lived in, hell, it might have come to pass in one way or another. But not now. It was clean and white out there, the lights over the parking lot just illuminating it enough, so much better than it usually looked. He'd done his part. Now it was someone else's turn to try his or her hand at the easier stuff. Yeah. Jack blew his smoke out of the window. First he'd have to break this habit again. Kathy would insist. And then? Then an extended vacation this coming summer. Maybe go back to England. Maybe by ship instead of flying. Take the time to drive around Europe. Maybe blow the whole summer. Be a free man again. Walk the beach. But then he'd have to get a job. Do something. Annapolis? No, that was out. Some private group? Maybe teach. Georgetown, maybe. Espionage 101. He chuckled to himself. That was it. He'd teach how to do all the illegal stuff. How the hell did James Greer ever last so long in this crummy racket? How had he handled the stress? That was one lesson he'd never passed on. You still need sleep, man, he reminded himself. This time, he made sure the TV was off. Chapter 34. Placement. Ryan was surprised to see that the snow hadn't stopped. The walkway outside his top-floor office window had almost 2 feet piled up, and the maintenance crews had failed completely to keep up with things through the night. High winds were blowing and drifting snow across the roads and parking lots more quickly than it could be removed, and even the snow that they did manage to move simply found another inconvenient place to blow over. It had been years since a storm like this had hit the Washington area. The local citizenry was already beyond panic into desperation, Jack thought. Cabin fever would already be setting in. Food stocks would not easily be replaced. Already some husbands and some wives were looking at their spouses and wondering how hard to cook they might be. It was one thing to laugh about as he went to get water for his coffee machine. He grabbed Ben Goodley's shoulder on the way out of the office. Shake it loose, Dr. Goodley. The eyes opened slowly.
What time is it?
7:20. What part of New England are you from originally?
New Hampshire. Up north. Place called Littleton.
Well, take a look out the window and it might remind you of home. By the time Jack returned with fresh water, the younger man was standing at the windows. Looks like about a foot and a half out there. Maybe a little more. So it's the big deal. Where I come from, this is called a flurry. In D.C., it's called the Ice Age. I'll have coffee ready in a few minutes. Ryan decided to call the security desk of the lobby.
What's the situation?
People calling in saying they can't make it. But what the hell? Most of the night staff couldn't get out. The GW Parkway is closed. So is the Beltway on the Maryland side and the Wilson Bridge. Again.
Outstanding. Okay, this is important, so listen up. That means anybody who makes it in is probably KGB trained. Shoot 'em. Goodley could hear the laughter on the phone from 10 feet away. Keep me posted on the weather situation, and reserve me a 4x4, the GMC, in case I have to go somewhere. Jack hung up and looked at Goodley. Rank hath its privileges. Besides, we have a couple of them.
What about people who have to get in?
Jack watched the coffee start to come out of the machine. If the Beltway and GW are closed, that means that 2/3 of our people can't get in. Now you know why the Russians have invested so much money in weather control programs.
Doesn't anybody down here?
No. People down here pretend that snow is something that happens on ski slopes. If it doesn't stop soon, it'll be Wednesday before anything starts moving in this town.
It's really that bad here?
You'll see for yourself, Ben.
And I left my cross-country skis up in Boston.
We didn't hit that hard, the major objected.
Major, the breaker board seems to disagree with you, the crew chief replied.
He pushed the breaker back in position. The small black plastic tab hesitated for a moment, then popped right back out.
No radio because of this one, and no hydraulics because of that one.
I'm afraid we're grounded for a while, sir. The metering pins for the landing gear had arrived at 2 in the morning on the second attempt. The first, aborted attempts, had been by car until someone had decided that only a military vehicle could make it. The parts had arrived by Humvee, and even that had been held up by the various stopped cars on the highways between Washington and Camp David. Repairs on the helicopter were supposed to have started in another hour or so. It was not a difficult job. But suddenly, they were more complicated.
Well? The major asked.
Probably a couple of loose wires in there.
I gotta pull the whole board, sir, inspect the whole thing. That's a whole day's work at best. Better tell them to warm up a backup aircraft. The major looked outside. This was not a day he wanted to fly anyway.
We're not supposed to go back until tomorrow morning. When'll it be fixed?
If I start now,
say around midnight,
get breakfast first. I'll take care of the backup bird.
Rajo, Major. I'll have them run some power out here for a heater and a radio, too.
The Major knew the crew chief was from San Diego. The Major trudged back to the cabin. The helicopter pad was on a high spot, and the wind was trying very hard to blow it clear of snow. As a result, there was only 6 inches to worry about. Down below, the drifts were as much as 3 feet deep. The grunts out walking the woods must be having a fine time, he thought.
How bad? The pilot asked, shaving.
Circuit panel is acting up. The chief says he needs all day to get it back online.
We didn't hit that hard, the colonel objected.
I already said that.
Want me to make the call?
Yeah, go ahead.
Have you checked the threat board?
The world's at peace, Colonel, sir. I checked.
The threat board was mainly an expression. The alert level of the government agencies that dealt with various problems depended on the expected level of danger in the world. The greater the possible danger, the more assets were kept ready to deal with them. At the moment, there was no perceived threat to the United States of America, and that meant that only a single aircraft was kept ready to backstop the president's VH-3. The major placed the call to Anacostia.
Yeah, let's keep -2 warm. -1 is down with electrical problems.
No, we can handle it here.
Ought to be back online by midnight.
Right.
Bye. The major hung up just in time for Pete Connor to enter their cabin.
What gives?
Birds broke, the colonel replied.
I didn't think we hit that hard, Connor objected.
Well, that makes it official, the major observed.
The only one who thinks we did hit that hard's the friggin' airplane.
The backup's on alert status, the colonel said as he finished shaving. Sorry, Pete. Electrical problem. Maybe had nothing to do with the touchdown. The backup can be here in 35 minutes. Our threat board is blank. Anything we need to know about? Connor shook his head. No, Ed. We know of no particular threat. I can bring the backup bird here, but it means exposing it to the weather. We can take better care of it down at Anacostia. That's your call, sir. You can leave it down there. The boss still wants to watch the game up here, right? Correct. We all get a day off. Lift off for D.C. tomorrow about 6:30. Problem with that? No, ought to be fixed before then. Okay. Connor left and walked back to his cabin.
What's it like out there? Daga asked.
About how it looks, Pete said. The chopper's broke.
I wish they'd be more careful, Special Agent Helen D'Agostino observed as she brushed her hair.
Not their fault. Connor lifted the phone to the Secret Service Command Center, located a few blocks west of the White House. This is Connor. The chopper is down with a mechanical problem. Backup is being kept at Anacostia because of weather conditions. Anything on the board I need to know about? No, sir, the junior agent responded. On his status board, in LED characters, he could see that the President of the United States, designated POTUS on his display, was shown to be at Camp David. The First Lady of the United States, FLOTUS, space, was blank. The Vice President was at his official residence on the ground of the U.S. Naval Observatory off Massachusetts Avenue, northwest, along with his family. Everything's nice and calm, far as we know. How are the roads down there? Pete asked. Bad. Every carry all we have is out retrieving people. Thank God for Chevrolet. Like the FBI, the Secret Service used the big Chevy four-wheel drive trucks to get around. Heavily armored and with roughly the fuel efficiency of a tank, the carry-all was able to do things that only a tank could excel. Okay, it's nice and snug up here. I bet the Marines are freezing their cojones off. What about Dulles? The Prime Minister is due in at 1800. The guys say Dulles has one runway open now. They expect to have everything clear by afternoon. Storm's slacking off a little here, finally. You know, the funny thing... Yeah. Connor didn't need to hear the rest. The funny thing was that weather like this made the job of the Secret Service easier. Okay, you know where to reach us. Right. See you tomorrow, Pete. Connor looked outside when he heard the noise. A Marine was driving a snowplow, trying to clear the paths between the cabins. Two more were working on the roads. It seemed rather odd. The equipment was painted in the Pentagon's woodland camouflage pattern of greens and browns, but the Marines were in their whites. There were even white pullover covers for their M16A2 rifles. Anyone who tried to get in here today would find too late that the perimeter guard force was totally invisible, and these Marines were all combat veterans. At times like this, even the Secret Service could relax, and that came rarely enough. There came a knock on the door. Daga got it. Morning papers, ma'am. A Marine corporal handed them over. You know, D'Agostino observed after she closed the door, sometimes I think the guys who deliver these things are the only people you can really depend on. What about the Marines? Pete asked with a laugh. Oh, them too. Aspect change in Sierra 16, the sonar man called. Target is coming left. Very well, Dutch Claggett replied. Mr. Pitney, you have the con. Aye, aye, sir, I have the con, the navigator said as the XO went into the sonar room. The fire control tracking party perked up, waiting to restart their calculations. Right there, sir. The sonar man tapped the screen with his pencil. Looks like a beam aspect now. Con, sonar, bearing is now 170, target is coming left. Radiated noise level is constant, estimate target speed is unchanged. Very well, thank you. It was the third such turn they had tracked. Claggett's estimation appeared to be correct. The Russian was conducting a very methodical, very conservative, and very smart search pattern of this patrol area, just like the 688s did in looking for Russian subs. The interval between the rungs of this ladder seemed to be about 40,000 yards.
X, that new feed pump they have is a beaut, the sonar man observed. His plant noise is way the hell down, and the sucker's doing 10 knots according to the tracking party.
Couple more years and we're gonna have to worry about these guys.
Transient, transient, mechanical transient on Sierra 16. Bearing is now 164, still drifting left. Speed constant. The petty officer circled the noise blip on the screen.
Maybe, sir, but they still got a lot to learn.
Range to target is now 48,000 yards.
Mr. Pitney, let's open the range some. Bring her right, the executive officer commanded.
I, helm, left 5 degrees rudder, come to new course 204.
Turning for another leg? Captain Ricks asked as he entered sonar.
Yeah, looks like the legs are pretty regular, Captain.
Methodical son of a bitch, isn't he?
Turned within 2 minutes of our estimate, Claggett replied. I just ordered us right to maintain distance.
Fair enough. Ricks was actually enjoying this. He hadn't been aboard a fast attack boat since his first assistant department head tour. Playing tag with Russian submarines was something he had not done in the past 15 years. On the rare occasions he'd heard them at all, his action had always been the same. Track long enough to determine the other sub's course, then turn perpendicular to it and head away until it faded back to random noise. Necessarily, the game was changing somewhat. It wasn't as easy as it used to be. The Russian subs were getting quieter. What had been an annoying trend a few years ago was rapidly turning into something genuinely troubling. And maybe we just had to change the way we do business.
You know, X, what if this becomes the standard tactic?
What do you mean, Captain?
I mean, as quiet as these guys are getting, maybe this is the smart move.
Huh? Claggett was lost.
If you're tracking the guy, at least you always know where he is. You can even launch a slot buoy and call in assets to help you dispose of him. Think about it. They're getting pretty quiet. If you break off as soon as you detect the guy, what's to say you don't blunder into him again?
So instead, we track at a nice safe distance and just keep an eye on him.
Captain... That's fine as far as it goes, but what if the other guy gets a sniff of us? Or what if he just reverses course and boogies backwards at high speed?
Good point. So we trail on his quarter instead of just off his stern. That will make an accidental closure less likely. Banging straight aft for a trailer is a logical defensive measure, but he can't go punching holes all over the ocean, can he?
Jesus, this guy is trying to develop tactics.
Sir, let me know if you sell that one to Oppo, too.
Instead of trailing dead aft, I'm going to hold off his northern quarter now. It gives us better performance off the tail, anyway. It should actually be safer.
That part of it made sense, Claggett thought.
You say so, Captain.
Maintain 50K yards?
Yes.
We still want to be a little cautious.
The second storm, as predicted, hadn't done very much, Gones saw. There was a light dusting. That seemed to be the term they used on the vehicles and parking lot. Hardly enough to bother with, it duplicated the most severe winter storm he'd ever seen in Lebanon.
How about some breakfast? Marvin asked. I hate to work on an empty stomach.
The man was remarkable, Ibrahim thought. He was completely free of jitters. Either very brave or something else.
Gone considered that. He'd killed the Greek policeman without a blink, had taught a brutal lesson to one of the organization's combat instructors, shown his prowess with firearms, and been completely contemptuous of danger when they'd uncovered the Israeli bomb. There was something missing in this man, he concluded. The man was fearless, and such men were not normal. It wasn't that he was able to control his fear, as most soldiers learn to do. Fear simply wasn't there. Was it merely a case of trying to impress people? Or was it real?
Probably real, Gone thought. And if it were, this man was truly mad, and therefore more dangerous than useful. It made things easier for Gon to think that. The motel didn't offer room service from its small coffee shop. All three walked out into the cold to get their breakfasts. Along the way, Russell picked up a paper to read about the game.
Conti and Gon only needed a brief look to find one more reason to hate Americans. They ate eggs with bacon or ham, and pancakes with sausage. In all three cases, products of the most unclean of animals, the pig. Both men found the sight and smell of pork products repulsive. Marvin didn't help when he ordered some as unconsciously as he'd ordered coffee. The commander, Gon noted, ordered oatmeal, and halfway through breakfast he went suddenly pale and left the table.
What's the matter with him anyway?
Sick? Russell asked.
Yes, Marvin. He is quite ill.
Gon looked at the greasy bacon on Russell's plate and knew the smell of it had set Cotty's stomach off.
I hope he's able to drive.
That will not be a problem.
Gon wondered if that were true.
Of course it was, he told himself. The commander had been through tougher times. But such bluster was for others, not for times like this.
No. Because there had never been such a time as this, the commander would do what must be done. Russell paid for the breakfast with cash, leaving a large tip because the waitress looked like a Native American. Cotty was pale when they got back to the rooms, and wiping his face after a long bout of nausea.
Can I get you something, man? Russell asked.
Milk? Something good for your stomach?
Not now, Marvin. Thank you.
You say so, man.
Russell opened his paper. There was nothing to do for the next few hours but wait. The morning line on the game, he saw, was Minnesota by 6.5. He decided that if anyone asked, he'd take the Vikings and give the points.
Special Agent Walter Hoskins, Assistant Special Agent in Charge, Corruption and Racketeering of the Denver Field Division, knew that he would miss the game despite the fact that his wife had given him a ticket for Christmas. This he had sold to the SAC for $200. Hoskins had work to do. A confidential informant had scored at the annual NFL Commissioner's Party last night. That party, like the ones preceding the Kentucky Derby, always attracted the rich, powerful, and important. This one had been no exception. Both U.S. senators from Colorado and California, a gaggle of congressmen, the state's governors, and approximately 300 others had attended. His CI had been at the table with Colorado's governor, senators, and the congresswoman from the 3rd District, all of whom were targets of his corruption case. Liquor had flowed, and in the vino had been the usual amount of Veritas. A deal had been made last night. The dam would be built. The payoffs had been agreed upon. Even the head of the Sierra Club's local branch had been in on it. In return for a large donation from the contractor and a new park to be authorized by the governor, the environmentalists would mute their objections to the project. The sad part, Hoskins thought, was that the area really needed the water project. It would be good for everyone, including the local fishermen. What made it illegal was that bribes were being made. He would have his choice of 5 federal statutes to apply to the case, the nastiest of which was the RICO law, the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act that had been passed over 20 years before without a thought about its possible scope of coverage. He already had one governor in a federal penitentiary, and to that he would add 4 more elected officials. The scandal would rip Colorado state politics asunder. The confidential informant in question was the governor's personal aide, an idealistic young woman who had decided 8 months earlier that enough was enough. Women were always best for wearing a wire, especially if they had large breasts, as this one did. The mic went right in the bra, and the geometry of the location made for good sound quality. It was also a safe spot because the governor had already sampled her charms and found them lacking. The old saw was right. Hell really did have no fury like a woman scorned. Well, Murray asked, annoyed to have to be in his office on another Sunday.
He'd had to ride the subway in, and now that was broken down. He might be stuck all day here.
Dan, we have enough to prosecute already, but I want to wait until the money gets passed to do that. My CI really delivered for us. I'm doing the transcript myself right now.
Can you fax it?
Soon as I'm done.
Dan, we've got them all by the ass. All of them.
Walt, we just might put up a statue to you, Murray said, forgetting his annoyance. Like most career cops, he loathed public corruption almost as much as he loathed kidnappers.
Dan, the transfer here is the best thing that ever happened to me. Hoskins laughed into the phone.
Maybe I'll run for one of the vacant Senate seats.
Colorado could do worse, Dan observed.
Just so you don't carry a gun anywhere, Murray thought unkindly. He knew that was unfair. Though Walt wasn't worth beans on the muscle end of the business, the other side of his assessment the previous year had also been correct. Hoskins was a brilliant investigator, a chess master to equal Bill Shaw, even. Walt just couldn't bring down a bust worth a damn.
Well, Murray corrected himself, this one wouldn't be very hard. Politicians hid behind lawyers and press spokesmen, not guns.
What about the U.S. attorney?
He's a good, sharp kid, Dan. He's on the team. Backup from the Department of Justice won't hurt, but the fact of the matter is that this guy can do it if he has to.
Okay. Shoot me the transcript when it's done.
Murray switched buttons on his phone, calling Shaw's home in Chevy Chase.
Yeah. Bill, Dan here, Murray said over the secure phone.
Hoskins scored last night. Says he's got it all on tape. All five principal subjects cut the deal over their roast beef.
You realize that we might have to promote the guy now, the FBI director noted with a chuckle.
So make him a deputy assistant director, Dan suggested.
That hasn't kept you out of trouble.
Do I need to come in?
Not really.
What's it like there?
I'm thinking of putting up a ski jump in the driveway. Roads really look bad.
I took the metro in, then it shut down. Ice on the tracks or something.
Washington, D.C., the city that panics, Shaw replied.
Okay, I plan to relax and watch the game, Mr. Murray.
And I, Mr. Shaw, will forego my personal pleasures and work for the greater glory of the Bureau.
Good. I like dedication in my subordinates. Besides, I got my grandson here, Shaw reported, watching his daughter-in-law feed him from a bottle.
How is Kenny Jr.?
Oh, we just might make an agent out of him. Unless you really need me, Dan.
Bill, enjoy the kid. Just remember to hand him back when he messes the diapers.
Right. Keep me posted on this. I'll have to take this to the president myself, you know.
You expect problems there?
No. He's a stand-up guy on corruption stuff.
I'll be back.
Murray walked out of his office toward communications. He found Inspector Pat O'Day heading the same way.
Were those your sled dogs I saw in the drive-thru, Pat?
Some of us drive decent cars.
O'Day had a four-wheel drive pickup. The Ninth Street barrier is frozen in the up position, by the way. I've told them to leave the other one down.
What are you in for?
I have the watch in the command center. My relief lives out in Frederick. I don't expect to see him until 30:30.
I-270 is closed until spring, I think.
Christ, this is a wimpy town when it snows.
Tell me about it.
O'Day's last field assignment had been in Wyoming, and he still missed the hunting out there.
Murray told the communications staff that the inbound fax from Denver was code word material. Nobody would get to see it but him for the moment.
I can't match this one, Goodley said just after lunch.
Which one?
The first one that shook us up. No, excuse me, the second one. I cannot reconcile Narmanov's and Spinnaker's schedules.
That doesn't necessarily mean anything.
I know. The odd thing is, remember what I said about linguistic differences in his reports?
Yeah, but remember my Russian is pretty thin. I can't catch nuances like you can.
This is the first place it shows up. and it's also the first one where I can't satisfy myself that they definitely met.
Goodley paused.
I think I might have something here.
Remember that you have to sell it to our Russian department.
That's not going to be easy.
That's right, Ryan agreed. Back it up with something, Ben. One of the security guys helped Clark with the case of bottles. He restocked the bar supplies, then headed to the upper level with the remaining 4 bottles of Chivas. Chavez tagged behind with the flowers. John Clark put the bottles in their places and looked around the compartment to be sure that everything was in order. He fussed with a few minor items to show that he was being sincere. The bottle with the transceiver in it had a cracked top. That should make sure that nobody tried to open it, he thought. Clever of the S&T guys, he thought. The simple things usually worked best. The flower arrangements had to be fastened in place. They were mainly white roses. Nice ones, Chavez thought, and the little green sticks that held them in place looked like they belonged. Ding next went downstairs and looked at the forward washrooms. In the trash bin of one, he dropped a very small, Japanese-made tape recorder, making sure beforehand that it was operating properly. He met Clark at the base of the spiral stairs, and then both left the aircraft. The advanced security people were just starting to arrive as they disappeared into the terminal's lower level. Once inside, both men found a locked room and used it to change clothes. They emerged dressed like businessmen, hair recombed, both wearing sunglasses.
They always this easy, Mr. C?
Nope. Both men walked to the opposite side of the terminal. This put them half a mile from the JAL-747, but with a direct line of sight to it. They could also see a Gulfstream 4 business jet liveried as a private aircraft. It was supposed to take off right before the Japanese aircraft, but would head on a diverging course. Clark took a Sony Walkman from his briefcase, inserted a tape cassette, and donned the earphones. In fact, he heard the murmurs of the security men on the aircraft, and the tape was recording their words as his eyes scanned a paperback book. It was a pity that he couldn't understand Japanese, Clark thought. As with most covert operations, the main component was sitting around and doing precisely nothing while he waited for something to happen. He looked up to see the red carpet being rolled out again, and the troops forming up and a lectern being set up. It must have been a real pain in the ass for the people who had to handle these things, he thought. Things picked up rapidly. The President of Mexico personally accompanied the Japanese Prime Minister to the aircraft, shaking his hand warmly at the base of the stairs. That might have been evidence right there, Clark thought. There was elation that the job was going well, but sadness that such things as this really happened. The party went up the stairs, the door closed, the stairs were hauled off, and the 747 started its engines. Clark heard the conversation pick up in the airplane's upstairs lounge. Then sound quality went immediately to hell when the engines fired up. Clark watched the Gulfstream begin taxiing off. The 747 began rolling 2 minutes later. It made sense. You had to be careful sending aircraft into the sky behind a jumbo. The big, wide bodies left behind wake turbulence that could be very dangerous. The 2 CIA officers remained in the observation lounge until the JAL airliner lifted off, and then their job was done. Aloft, the Gulfstream climbed out to its cruising altitude of 41,000 feet on a heading of 026, inbound to New Orleans. The pilot eased off on the throttles somewhat, coached by the men in the back. Off to their right, the 747 was leveling off at the same altitude, on a course of 031. Inside the bigger aircraft, the supposed bottle of scotch was pointed out a window, and its EHF transmissions were scattering out toward the Gulfstream's receptors. The very favorable data bandwidth of the system guaranteed a good signal, and no less than 10 tape recorders were at work, 2 for each separate sideband channel. The pilot eased his course as far east as he dared until the 2 aircraft were over the water, then he turned back left as a second aircraft, this one an EC-135 that had struggled to get out of Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma, took up station 30 miles east and 2,000 feet below the larger Boeing product. The first aircraft landed at New Orleans, unloaded its men and equipment, refueled, then lifted off to head back to Mexico City. Clark was at the embassy. One of his additions to the operation was a Japanese speaker from the agency's intelligence directorate. Reasoning that his test reception would be useful to determine the effectiveness of the system, he had further decided that it would be better still to get an immediate read on what was being said. Clark thought that this was a reasonable demonstration of operational initiative. The linguist took his time, listening to the taped conversation three times before he started typing. He generated less than two pages. It annoyed him that Clark was reading over his shoulder.
"I wish it was this easy to make a deal with the opposition in the Diet," Clark read aloud. "We merely must take care of some of his associates also."
"Looks to me that we got what we want," the linguist observed.
"Where's your communications guy?" Clark asked the station chief.
"I can do it myself." It was indeed easy enough. The station chief transcribed the two typed pages into a computer. Attached to the computer was a small machine that looked like a video disc machine. On the large disc were literally billions of random digital numbers. Each letter he typed was randomly transformed into something else and transmitted to the Mercury room at Langley. Here the incoming signal was recorded. A communications technician selected the proper description disc from the secure library, slid it into his own machine, and pressed a button. Within seconds, a laser printer generated two pages of clear text message. This was sealed in an envelope and handed to a messenger who made for the seventh floor office of the deputy director.
"Dr. Ryan, the dispatch you were waiting for?"
"Thank you." Jack signed for it. "Dr. Goodley, you're going to have to excuse me for a moment."
"No problem."
Ben went back to his pile of papers. Ryan pulled the dispatch out and read it slowly and carefully twice. Then he picked up the phone and asked for a secure line to Camp David.
"Command Center," a voice answered.
"This is Dr. Ryan at Langley. I need to talk to the boss."
"Wait one, sir," the Navy Chief Petty Officer replied. Ryan lit a cigarette.
"This is the President," a new voice said.
"Mr. President, this is Ryan. I have a fragment of conversation off the 747.
"So soon?"
"It was made before engine startup, sir."
"We have an unidentified voice. We think it's the PM, saying that he made the deal."
Jack read off three lines verbatim.
"That son of a bitch," Fowler breathed. "You know, with evidence like that, I could prosecute a guy."
"I thought you'd want this fast, sir.
I can fax you the initial transcript. The full one will take until 2100 or so.
It'll be nice to have something to read after the game."
"Okay, send it up." The line went dead.
"You're welcome, sir," Jack said into the phone.
"It is time," Gone said.
"Okay." Russell stood up and got into his heavy coat. It would be a really cold one outside. The predicted high temperature was 6 above, and they were not there yet. A bitter northeast wind was sweeping down out of Nebraska, where it was even colder. The only good thing about that was the clear sky it brought. Denver is also a city with a smog problem made all the worse by winter temperature inversions. But today the sky was literally cloudless, and to the west Marvin could see streams of snow being blown off the Front Range peaks like white banners. Surely it was auspicious, and the clear weather meant that the flight out of Stapleton would not be delayed as he had feared a few days before. He started the engine of the van, rehearsing his lines and going over the plan as he allowed the vehicle to heat. Marvin turned to look at the cargo. "Almost a ton of super high explosives," Ibrahim had said. That would really piss people off. Next, he got into the rental car and started that one too, flipping the heater all the way on. Shame that Commander Cotty felt so bad. Maybe it was nerves, Russell thought. A few minutes later, they came out. Gone got in next to Marvin. He was nervous, too.
"Ready, man?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
Russell dropped the van into reverse and backed out of the parking place. He pulled forward, checking that the rental car was following, then headed off the parking lot onto the highway.
The drive to the stadium required only a few uneventful minutes. The police were out in force, and he saw that Gohn was eyeing them very carefully. Marvin was not concerned. The cops were only there for traffic control, after all, and they were just standing around since